Ed Robertson, welcoming you back to TV Confidential Radio Talk Show about television. That's happy to welcome back our friend Ray Richmond. Ray Richmond, longtime television critic and entertainment reporter for such trade publications as The Hollywood Reporter and Daily Variety, and the author of several books on television, including comprehensive guides on the making of The Simpsons and Jeopardy, as well as TV Moms, an illustrated guide, and Betty White, 100 Remarkable Moments. Ray's latest book, The Sopranos, The Complete Visual History, celebrates the 25th anniversary of the premiere of The Sopranos on HBO. The Sopranos, the multi-Emmy award-winning drama created by David Chase and starring James Gandolfini, that broke new ground in television when it premiered in 1999, launching the current golden age of dramatic television on cable and digital platforms, while also setting a benchmark for the ongoing evolution of television with its innovative storytelling techniques and non-linear narratives, and taking the concept of anti-hero as protagonist for a weekly television series to an entirely different level. Though hardly the first attempt to portray mob life in movies and or television, what made The Sopranos truly unique was the idea of portraying mob boss Tony Soprano as anxious, depressed, and in need of psychotherapy. As Ray Richmond says in The Sopranos, the complete visual history on his face, that is an uproarious conceit. In practice, as we saw every week on The Sopranos, it was alternately revealing, stressful, occasionally frightening, and yet in many respects highly comical. We'll tell you where you can find The Sopranos, the complete visual history, in just a second. But first, we began our conversation by telling Ray Richmond that his book is gorgeous. It is gorgeous to behold. It is gorgeous to thumb through, and most importantly, read. And that's a good way to start our conversation, because in a way, the title of your book, The Complete Visual History of The Sopranos, in a way, the subtitle of the book is misleading, and I'm going to tell you why. On the one hand, as we just have been riffing on, it is beautifully designed, lots of full-color photographs, lots of full-color behind-the-scenes exclusive photographs. And folks, full-color is a publishing term. It means it is vivid, high-definition, jump-off-the-page, as close to three-dimensional color as you can imagine. So that's what we're looking at visually. It is strikingly visual in that respect, and yet it is not just a glossy coffee table book, Ray. It is thoughtfully written. It is a very analytical look at the series as a whole and the various themes that resonate from season to season.
Thank you for that. You know, that, Ed, I so appreciate that assessment, and I'm grateful for that view, because the truth is, we didn't have a lot of time. Usually you'll have a year, 10 months to a year, to put together something like this. And the truth is, they started on it really late. The idea was to tie into the 25th anniversary, which was in January of 2024.
Mm-hmm.
And we started work on it basically in August, September of 24. And so we're already behind the eight ball. They wanted to get it out as quickly as possible. August, September 23.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's a huge lead time for things like that.
Absolutely.
I had an amazing editor and a woman named Rebecca Razzo and a great designer and design team. And, you know, we were just determined that people were not going to see us sweat, and they weren't going to see all the work behind it. They were, you know, because nobody cares how long it takes you or doesn't take you to put mm-hmm. something together. All they care about is the finished product that they have in their hands, and we're charging top dollar for this thing, $65. So it had better jump off the page. And it had to be different at the same time, Ed, than the other, you know, there have been a handful of other Sopranos compendiums and you know, and a cookbook
mm-hmm.
and all kinds of other things Sopranos. So it wasn't like this was the first thing, you know, that was dedicated to the show that it, in a comprehensive way. So it had to be different than all that had come before it. And sometimes that's the biggest challenge, is to make something distinctive.
Well, I'll tell you one thing that makes the book distinctive. And this is going to appeal to all English majors out there. It's going to appeal to my former college professors who wonder, you know, what are you doing talking about television? Why aren't you applying all the analytical skills you learned when you were an undergraduate? You do that, man, because you not only include, there are a ton of behind-the-scenes interviews with all the principal, with many of the principal players of the show, including series creator and executive producer David Chase. But as I say, you go into the various themes that permeate throughout the series, and as you go through each season, you pick one or two identifying themes, like family, or in the first season, you know, motherhood, both motherhood as portrayed by Olivia and motherhood as portrayed by Carmela. And you really, I mean, this is not just a TV show. You give the readers an understanding of why this is such a cultural phenomenon and continues to reach new viewers today.
Yeah, that's what we're, thank you again for that, too, Ed. What we were really determined to do is, because this show is art, you know, this is not traditional television in any way. You know how HBO always used to be, it's not television, it's HBO. Mm-hmm. Well, in this case, I mean, The Sopranos really was, in a 13-episode season, it was basically 13 movies. And it had the production values of movies. And we realized we need this thing to be as artistic as, this book to be as artistic as the show itself to stand out. So we wanted it, we gave it, as you said, every chapter a theme, you know, whether it be motherhood or trust or, you know, or family values, you know, issues with loyalty. You know, we wanted to make it every chapter its own kind of mini book in itself, distinctively behind the scenes. And, you know, I was lucky to be able to get everyone, so many people from the show, mm-hmm. you know, including Edie Falco for interviews, including Lorraine Bracco, Stephen Van Zandt.
Dominic Chianese, Jerry Adler, who plays one of my favorite minor characters of the show, Hesh.
Hesh Rapkin, yeah. Right.
And the two principal casting people on the show, Ray talked to them, Ray talked to David Chase, Ray talked to everybody he could conceivably get a hold of.
Directors, writers, production designers, everybody. And, you know, of course, the big gap, Ed, as you know, is there is no James Gandolfini.
Absolutely.
You know, unfortunately, he passed away very young. And, you know, that was an interesting thing in itself, is you hear so many different things about James. You hear about his being incredibly generous to the crew and the cast, but you also heard about him being incredibly difficult to pin down, and how he was, you know, something of a prima donna and, you know, going through his own issues, being the star of a show when he was always basically the, you know, just a character actor before this, and suddenly being the guy. There's a lot of pressure on someone's shoulders, you know, and not just the memorization of it all, but inhabiting that, suddenly being incredibly famous and not being able to go anywhere. I wished I could have talked to him about that, because that was he was in almost every scene of the show.
Yes.
You know, he was the Sopranos, and you got different outlooks from everyone about him. There were a few people that were a little more honest about him, to be quite frank, you know, who were like, I really had, you know, like one director in particular had real problems with him. But basically, a lot of that stuff was edited out because they didn't want it to be controversial. They
yeah.
wanted it to be much more supportive, you know, and because HBO was behind it, they have no interest in trying to assess anything about the cast and the storylines. They're just, this is strictly promotional from their perspective. So my hope was that it didn't come across at all as kind of a PR puff job. I really wanted it to be insightful about, at least about the characters and about all the work that went into the show.
Well, no, I think we've addressed that. It is not just a glossy coffee table book. It is a book that if you pick up and read and read each chapter, each page, as if you're a fan of The Sopranos, you're going to be want to do anyway, because it's the type of book that you're going to want next to you, as you sit on the couch, binge watching you know, the episodes or revisiting the episodes as many people are going to do. It is a very depthful book. That book being The Sopranos, a complete visual history by our guest Ray Richmond, a rich photographic journey through the trials and tribulations of TV's most celebrated anti-hero, Tony Soprano. The Sopranos, a complete visual history, available wherever books are sold through Insight Editions. You can also find it at Amazon.com, where books are sold online, those outlets as well. Before I forget, you mentioned, okay, this is a book that you did not have a lot of lead time to put this book together. So it's amazing that it came out as beautiful and as rich and colorful as it is. How did you get involved in this project, Ray?
I had actually worked with, you might remember that I wrote a book about Betty White just before she passed, and, mm-hmm. and in fact you interviewed me on your fine television Confidential show about that book. One of the same people who worked for the publishing company on my Betty White book was working now for this different company, and we had a really successful time, you know, on the Betty White book. It did incredibly well, you know. It was a bestseller in Walmart and Target, so it did well beyond the online world. And they knew that I had a long history of being a television critic and just being involved in television journalism in general. And to be honest, they kind of pursued me and were like, okay, you know, here's how much time. You know, I had a full time job and I have a teaching job. I teach TV history at a local university, at Chapman University in Orange County. So I had plenty on my plate. And they were like, no, 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 we really need you for this. And I'm like, I just don't have time. And they're like, well, look, you know, you can have your – to have my name on something, Sopranos, was the lure. And I'm like, okay, I'm just going to find time. I'm just going to carve out time and somehow do it. So, you know, I said no 5 times before I said yes. There were plenty of other people who could have done this, arguably just as well. But I'm grateful now, especially that they did bug me into it, and being able to go and talk to the cast members and everything else. I mean, it was just such a pleasure because these people, Carmela and Meadow and AJ and Dr. Melfi and Silvio, these people are. They became family members to us on this show. I mean, it was like we were all kind of extended, you know, Italian family members. It was an honor and a pleasure. And I feel like this is kind of, at this point, the definitive book about this show. But we can't get over it. You know, and, you know, one of the reasons why it holds up so incredibly well. I was able to, you know, I watched every episode 3 times. So it was a huge amount of work. But it just holds up incredibly well, and it's one of those shows that's never going to go out of style because it's the storylines and the characters. It's always about the characters. People wonder why do we remember Seinfeld? Why do we remember Cheers? Why do we remember, you know, The Sopranos and Breaking Bad and the shows like this show that sparked a drama golden age, you know, Mad Men. It's always the characters. These are people that we can relate to, that we inhabit, who make us think about our own situations and who we care about. And we cared about these guys. And, you know, people ask me, who is my favorite character on the show? And it's really easy. It's Tony Sirico, who played Polly. because every time, I swear to God, Ed, every time, you know, Polly Walnuts showed up on screen, I just started, I got this hole in the pit of my stomach. The guy just scared the crap out of me. There was just something about him that just makes you cringe. And it wasn't a surprise to find out that Tony Sirico was the one member of the cast who actually had real mob ties.
Yeah.
It was a genuine good fella himself, who had been in and out of prison before his acting career. So obviously, everybody's favorite character is Tony, but
my favorite character was Melfi.
Melfi was a, you know what? And Lorraine Bracco will tell you that this was, even though, of course, she'd been in Goodfellas herself, mm-hmm. you know, she will tell you that her, she, that this was the role of her life.
Mm-hmm.
And she had to really rein it in, and, you know, because Melfi was so controlled.
Yeah.
And so, you know, straight ahead. And that was not her. That's not Lorraine Bracco. Lorraine Bracco is always wild and crazy and loved to party and loves to, you know, and she was like, I had to just completely rein in my all of my artistic impulses to play this woman. So it was real acting what you were seeing. Like I don't a single genuine therapist bone in my body. This was just acting all on display.
Yeah, but at the same time as she tells you, Ray, in The Sopranos, The Complete Visual History, now available wherever books are sold through Insight Editions, she did not have a quote-unquote Melfi or, you know, therapist bone in her body. She knew from her own experience how helpful therapy could be, so she was able to approach it that way. And
yes.
and that was the foundation on which she built her performance.
That's actually true. And, well, as any actor who's been around for a while will tell you, I don't think there's – Ed, let's face it, there's probably not an actor in Hollywood who's been around for any amount of time that isn't in therapy. I mean, come on. But I mean, everybody that I spoke to, just, you know, all of the actors said that this was basically the, you know, the greatest experience of their life and gave them such pleasure to do creatively and put them on the map. You know, I mean, these guys would talk about walking around New York during the time that the show was being produced. And, you know, if they're walking down Broadway, people would be cheering. You know, like construction workers would be standing up and applauding. I mean, they were superstars. And you don't have too many of those experiences in your life as an actor. If you have one, you're incredibly lucky.
The Sopranos, The Complete Visual History, Rich Photographic Journey Through the Trials and Tribulations of TV's Most Celebrated Anti-Hero, Tony Soprano, as he attempts to balance the responsibility of domestic life with life in the quote-unquote family, mob family, that is, all while suffering through panic attacks, a toxic mother, and a power-hungry uncle who would rather see him dead than boss. The Sopranos, A Complete Visual History by our guest, Ray Richmond, available wherever books are sold through Insight Editions. You can also find it Amazon.com, where books are sold online. I want to circle back to one point you mentioned earlier. And not that I don't want to suggest that you and I are peers, but I would just tell you, you know, speaking from freelancer to freelancer, it is always good when they want you. Because 9 times out of 10, it's you pitching them to get your foot in the door. But so when they come after you, that's a nice position to be in. And I just want to explain, that doesn't happen all the time.
No, it's true. It's true, Ed. And I was in-
Ray Richmond is the author of The Sopranos, The Complete Visual History, everything you want to know about the iconic HBO drama that is widely regarded as one of the greatest television shows of all time. Ray will be back next week for part two of our conversation. We'll continue to talk about the various ways in which The Sopranos changed the landscape of television over the past 25 years. Plus, we'll talk about the famous final episode of The Sopranos and how, depending on how you look at it, it is either the greatest or most aggravating series finale ever conceived. Ray Richmond will be back next week on TV Confidential. In the meantime, The Sopranos, The Complete Visual History, available wherever books are sold through Insight Edition. Take a quick time out. We'll be back with more TV Confidential right after this. One more item. Are you starting a company in an emerging market or developing something new? Do you have intellectual property but aren't sure how to protect it? Reach out to our friends at Tectonic Law. They offer rock-solid representation for groundbreaking industries who need help capturing and protecting their full portfolio of intellectual property and intangible assets, including trademark rights, copyright rights, and privacy rights. Tectonic Law streamlines the complex intricacies of intellectual property and business law in easy-to-understand terms that will help you and your company form a concrete plan of action to secure and protect the value of your brand and your creative work product. Tectonic Law is licensed to practice throughout the state of California. They also practice before such tribunals as the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office and Internet Corporation for assigned names and numbers. Go to tectoniclaw.com to learn more about how Tectonic Law can help your business thrive. Tectoniclaw.com. Rock solid representation for groundbreaking industries.
Buying or selling a home can be one of the most stressful things we'll ever do in life, but it doesn't have to be. And no one knows better than our friends at Front Porch Realty. Their community of realtors serving the Northern Bay Area of California that cares about their clients as individuals first and foremost. Whether you're a first-time buyer or looking to lease or sell your property in the Bay Area, Front Porch Realty will help you through this important transition by providing you with the right information for your situation while lessening the pain. They also work with a network of realtors throughout California who provide the same high caliber of customer service. Call Karen Strain at 415-886-7411 for a realtor referral near you. You can also visit their website, frontporchrealtygroup.com, for more information on the services they provide, including upcoming workshops and seminars. For more information, call Karen Strain at 415-886-7411 or visit frontporchrealtygroup.com. Front Porch Realty. They'll find the solution that works best for you.
At Robertson Law, the guest Joseph Doherty. Joseph Doherty, Emmy Award-winning writer, producer, and director of 30-something and Pretty Little Liars, and the author of the award-winning play Chester Bailey, starring David Fairbairn. Joe's latest book, Rod Serling at 100, One Writer's Acknowledgement, is an appreciation and exploration of the six-time Emmy Award-winning writer that not only takes a deep dive into the vast catalog of Rod Serling, but shares many stories of why the work of Rod Serling means so much to Joe personally. Rod Serling at 100, One Writer's Acknowledgement, available right now through Fayetteville Mafia Press and Amazon.com. Before we went to break, Joe and I were talking about one of the Easter eggs in Rod Serling at 100, that being a brief excerpt from an interview that Rod Serling gave on the Dick Cavett Show in July 1972, about 2 months before the start of Night Gallery's third season on NBC, in which Rod Serling spoke very candidly about his frustration with both Universal Studios and NBC over the direction Night Gallery had taken, and how Serling had no creative control or any say whatsoever on a show that bore his name on the title. As we pick up the conversation, I'm thinking aloud here, and I would have to go back to Rod Serling's Night Gallery and After Hours tour by Scott Skelton and Jim Benson to determine this for sure. But what I know and what I remember about Night Gallery entering the 72-73 season was two things. One, they had changed the format. It was a 60-minute show, but they, for budgetary reasons, they cut it down to a 30-minute show.
They did it, yeah. The third season is a half hour.
Yeah, and they had moved it from Wednesday night, where it had thrived, Wednesday night's 10 o'clock, to Sunday night's 10 o'clock, entering the third season. Now, Sunday night is normally considered a good time slot, but back in the day, they scheduled it for 10 o'clock, from 10 to 10:30 on Sunday night after the mystery movie. Well, back in 1972, the Sunday night broadcast time was 7:30 to 10:30. And because of the public access rule, 10:30 to 11 was considered local. You had to do air local programming. So they put it up. So even though it was quote unquote a good time slot, because Sunday night was the highest viewing night, it still is the highest viewing night in television. They aired it at a time where it was running opposite either movies or shows that started at 9:30, and the odds are that you're not going to switch from at 10 o'clock to in the middle of what you're watching just to watch Night Gallery. Now, I don't know whether they made that scheduling decision for the Cavett interview or after the Cavett interview, but if it was after, maybe it was in retaliation for what he said.
It might have been, but I think basically then they would have been picking their own pockets, and yeah. I don't know if that worked. Okay, here's a quick test for you. What would have been the lead-in for the mystery movie on Sunday?
Disney.
Okay. Oh, brother, what a night.
Yeah.
No.
I think Disney ran 7:30 to 8:30. Then the mystery movie ran 8:30 to 10 or 10:30 if the mystery movie ran 2 hours. That was another thing that hurt the third season of Night Gallery, because most of the mystery movies, the McLeods, the McMillan and Wife, the McLeod and the McMillan and Wife mystery movies, they were 90 minutes back then, 8:30 to 10. Columbo, sometimes it was a 90.
Yeah.
Sometimes, such as the case is the one with John Cassavetes.
Yeah, like if it's a season opener, I think they usually try to go. But yeah, when I look at them, I can just clock. This is 75 minutes, so this must be okay.
Yeah. So the fact that sometimes it aired and sometimes it didn't, that hurt. I think that hurt the final, what turned out to be the final.
Yeah,
and that's why they ended up canceling it mid-season.
Yeah, and then of course we come to the fact that it was, you can talk about what was done deliberately and what wasn't done deliberately, but what happened to the Night Gallery and syndication is really close to criminal. Except for the Twilight Zone episodes were clipped for time as they went into syndication, which was unfortunate, but at least they were intact as far as that's concerned. Night Gallery was basically eviscerated and was distributed as half hours. It contained episodes from two other television series.
I knew about Sixth Sense. What was the other show?
I don't know. I can't remember now, but there was another one that they just kind of jammed in. It could have been My Mother the Car. I'm not sure.
It could have been My Mother the Car. To find out the answer to that for sure, pick up a copy of Rod Stewart at 100. One writer's – see, we look for ways to do the second.
Bring it back. You're very good at bringing things back.
Rod Serling at 100, one writer's acknowledgement, available right now through Fayetteville Mafia Press as well as Amazon.com. Bringing it back to the Twilight Zone. Okay.
Yeah. So, it's just just to kind of really to circle all the way back.
Actually, I meant to say bring it back to Night Gallery. I did a Joe Doherty. I conflated two things.
I know it can hurt sometimes. because this is interesting. Any conversation, I think it speaks to Night Gallery. And which gets conflated sometimes. I talk to people who think things were back and forth. But the Twilight Zone too is that any conversation about the Twilight Zone usually devolves or evolves into people saying, remember the one, that one where that. Is that the things stick in our minds. And one of the great, I wish that there was a way for Rod to know the impact that his very good work, he meant it, he was sincere. Good, bad, or indifferent, I don't think Rod Serling wrote an insincere word in his life.
I agree.
He took authorship very seriously, which is why when you look at, again, on Paramount Plus, or if you look at the Blu-rays, which include the billboards for the original broadcast episodes, in which he promos next week's show. I have not seen one of those promos where he doesn't say the name of the writer next episode, unless it was on his, and then he doesn't talk about it. Yeah. And again, it's like you can call Rod the first of the showrunners, but you also have to think about maybe something a little beyond that. That Rod Serling was an author of television, which goes back to your literature. And I think I wanted to service that. And his work and his experience, his life have been very important to me. I make no bones about it. I really don't think I would have had a career if I hadn't been exposed to his work. And I've just got, so what the book is like it says on the cover, it's acknowledgement and gratitude.
Yes, and as we said at the beginning of our conversation, it is a series of personal essays about the impact that the work of Rod Serling had on you when you first discovered him at 8 years old and continues to have on you to this day. I want to touch on a couple of things before we say goodbye. And this is circling back to the whole Night Gallery conundrum. We talked about how even though it has his name on the show, it doesn't have a stamp on the show for reasons you explained and that Jim and Scott Skelton have explained. And yet it includes one episode in particular that is widely considered one of the best things he ever wrote, which is they're tearing down Tim Riley's bar.
Yes, yes. And it's interesting to look at Tim Riley's bar because it seems to exist in a space between the two series in that you can very easily see it as a Twilight Zone episode. It's basically a man at the end of, as is the case with so many characters in so many episodes, a man at the end of his rope. And what happens? Does he let go of the rope? Does he find a way to pull himself up on the rope? I think, and I talk about this in the book because, you know, I think if it was a Twilight Zone episode, it would have had a different ending. Because the ending of the Night Gallery episode, which is it's William Wyndham.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. I think there's something that I think the Night Gallery guys talked about this too, is when they realized how good Tim Riley's bar was, they were furious that they only had William Wyndham in it. Why didn't you tell me this was that good? We could have gotten somebody really big for this. But it's a melancholy episode. It's about loss and the inability to let go of things to move forwards. So it really is, it lives not only in the Twilight Zone, but I think it also lives in his earlier pieces. You can compare it to Patterns, his breakthrough piece of 1955, which was all about what happens if you're in a job, what is the purpose of the job and why are you there? See, there's that, and there are one or two others like Cool Air, which do stand out as no, there's more. It's almost, to a certain extent, maybe it's a little bit, oh gosh. And I don't think it's not a Rod script, but there's the one about the sin eater and the sins of the father. And there's some Mathesons in there.
I think
and
so. Some,
and Theodore and Theodore J. Flicker is actually involved as his name, which is a writer people don't talk about enough.
Theodore Flicker, among his many contributions to television, he's the co-creator of Barney Miller. And even though he had nothing to do with the series as we know it that Danny Arnold produced and that Hal Linden starred in for 10 years, he wrote the pilot for a show that was developed into Barney Miller, and because the pilot was based on something he originated by guild rule,
yeah,
gets the created by credit.
You know, and because it's Theodore J. Flicker who wrote The President's Analyst, I really don't begrudge the fact that he got the check. He has to, didn't work a day on the show. So, yeah, but you know what? It's Theodore J. Flicker and you know what? He probably, it's not a big check. Send him the check.
Well, look.
Then you want to start a conversation of Barney Miller. I mean, the series continued to be developed during the first year.
Yeah. Yeah. No, we could talk about the Huggins contract too, which is one of the clauses in the Huggins contract is, and it just speaks to how smart and savvy and what's the word I'm looking for? Forward thinking.
Mm-hmm.
For lack of a better word, Roy was, is that the Huggins contract included a clause that has benefited many, many other writer producers in the 50 some years afterwards, which is if I create a show and you buy that show, Joe, and whether that show runs for one episode or 121 episodes, and whether I have anything to do with the writing or production of those one shows, or 121 shows, because I created that show, I'm entitled to a piece of the action for that show for as long as that show is in production. And that groused some people, James Garner being one, but it benefited many, many, many others, and who were able to benefit from the same, and Theodore Flicker being one of them.
The thing to remember, I mean, and Huggins' example and his ability to look ahead, it's like basically is like, I mean, you know, I've been on a couple of picket lines and I've had people yell at me for being a rich Hollywood writer and why aren't you, you know, and I usually just say to them, listen, I got a 10-year-old car and a mortgage. So, television writing is, this is not my quote. This is somebody else's. It's a sports career. It's a long sports career, but it is a sports career. And the actions of generous guild members like Roy Huggins, who made it possible to not just have a job, but have a career as a writer.
Yeah.
I begrudge not a single one of those checks.
And that's a good analogy because you say it's a sports career and that in most cases you have, if you're lucky, you have one thing that sustains you for 3 or 4 years, but there's no guarantee that you're going to have a long career because it's not necessarily built for longevity. But in the case of, you know, certain exceptions such as Joseph Doherty, you know, because of hard work and talent and, you know, good fortune in some cases. And
don't forget dumb luck.
No, as Paul Newman, I don't know whether he was the first guy who said this, but Paul Newman is the one who said it that I remember saying it. Any successful person who does not acknowledge the presence of luck is a liar, because a lot of times dumb luck is the difference between success and failure.
I'll give you the other side of that. I know I'm interrupting your thought, which is basically I once said to someone very early. Very, very early, I had a conversation with an agent, and I was saying, I said I was feeling a little guilty because I was feeling, you know, it's all this luck that had come to me. And he said, and again, this wasn't his original line, but it's the one that stuck with me. He says, luck means nothing if you're not prepared to take advantage of it.
Exactly. And the ones who were able to take advantage of that opportunity because they were ready, they had done the work to prepare themselves for that moment, that makes a difference. And so, Rod Serling at 101 Writers Acknowledgement by Joseph Doherty, available Fayetteville Mafia Press and Amazon.com.
Joe, stay with us for one more segment. We hope you'll stay with us as we continue our conversation here on TV Confidential.
If you turned 65 recently like me, it's important you find a Medicare Advantage plan that gives you the coverage you're looking for. But finding one can be difficult. The best thing I did, and I suggest you do the same, is call a licensed insurance agent and let them walk you through your Medicare Advantage plan options. There are so many benefits you have access to, so make the call now and let the representatives explain everything to you. Our licensed insurance agents can offer you a variety of Medicare Advantage plans. Plus, the call is free, the information is free, and there's no obligation to enroll. We're here to make it easy for you to select a Medicare Advantage plan that may work for your needs. Finding a Medicare Advantage plan can be easy if you do what I did. Make a quick call right now to learn more. Thank you.
800-841-9670. 800-841-9670. 800-841-9670. That's 800-841-9670.
One more item. If you're starting a company, particularly one that is in an emerging market, you know that averting any sort of legal dispute is crucial to your business plan. Our friends at Tectonic Law offer an array of services that can help you avoid and preempt future litigation while also developing and protecting your intellectual property and intangible assets. Tectonic Law serves the needs of a host of emerging industries throughout California and beyond, including industrial designers, beverage makers, artists, farmers, retail stores, health practitioners, wellness experts, cosmetics manufacturers, nonprofit organizations, innovators in sustainable practices, and libraries. Go to tectoniclaw.com to learn more about how Tectonic Law can help your business thrive. Tectoniclaw.com, rock solid representation for groundbreaking industries.
This portion of TV Confidential is brought to us by our friends at Front Porch Realty, the community of realtors in the Northern Bay area of California that is committed to finding the solution that is best for their clients. Whether you're a first-time home buyer or looking to sell or lease your property in Northern California, call Karen Strain at 415-886-7411 or visit frontporchrealtygroup.com for more information on how they can help you.
Ed Robertson with a reminder that the next edition of TV Confidential will premiere next week on this station at the usual time. We'll play part two of our conversation with Ray Richmond, author of The Sopranos, The Complete Visual History. Plus, we'll welcome back Stephanie Powers, the actress known around the world as Jennifer Hart on Heart to Heart. In the meantime, we will round out this week's program by playing more highlights of the opening night ceremonies for the new Happy Trails exhibit at the Hollywood Museum. Happy Trails, new exhibit honoring the life and legacy of Roy Rogers and Dale Evans that features a host of never-before-seen personal items from the collection of the Roy Rogers family, plus photos, collectibles, merchandise, and a whole lot more. The Hollywood Museum, located 1660 North Highland Avenue at Hollywood Boulevard. Tickets and more information, thehollywoodmuseum.com. The Hollywood Museum held a special preview of the Roy Rogers Dale Evans exhibit on the night before it opened to the public. TV Confidential was at the museum that night. We're bringing you highlights from some of the guest speakers who shared some of their memories of Roy Rogers and Dale Evans. As we bring you back to the museum, the next voice you'll hear will be Steve Michelmo, Director of Operations at the Hollywood Museum, introducing the next speaker that night, Dawn Moore, daughter of Clayton Moore, the Lone Ranger.
Dawn Moore grew up in the world of Westerns as the daughter of the legendary Clayton Moore, who portrayed the iconic Lone Ranger. As for her own career, Dawn had no interest in working in entertainment, preferring a business career in luxury retail. Having appeared on E!, Entertainment Tonight, Extra, Access Hollywood, and more, Dawn has certainly learned a lot about TV industry and was instrumental in producing the 1998 autobiography about her father, I Was That Masked Man. Please welcome Dawn Moore.
I was actually going to come up here and say I have no film cred, but it sounds like I do. Does that mean? So since I have no film cred, I have to back up into my father's film cred. So we're going to talk about, I might have to grab that from you, this guy and this guy.
Dawn is holding a photo of her father, Clayton Moore, appearing with Roy Rogers in the 1948 Western, The Far Frontier.
Now, you guys can't see in the back, but this is 1948, The Far Frontier. Okay, classic Republic Studio movie Western, right? Somehow, this guy has got the King of the Cowboys and all of the Sons of the Pioneers behind bars. One year later, this guy becomes the Lone Ranger. And this guy is out behind the bars. Fast forward from the 40s, where there was a little bit of battles between the two of them. So for Dad's 80th birthday, I planned this huge party at the Auction Museum. It was pretty spectacular. And I would, you know, come up and send the invitations out and hope to God people are going to come, at least they're going to RSVP. And I send the invitations out, and I come home every day because this is in the day of, you may remember, well, there's mail, yes, but an Android machine, right? Little things beeping, you're all excited, you come home when there's beeping. And so I play this, I hit the play thing, and it's, hi, Dawn, this is Dale Evans. I'm so sorry, Roy and I aren't going to be able to join your father, but Roy's a little under the weather, but thank you so much for joining us, and tell your father happy birthday from both of us. Click. And I did not care that they now all of a sudden were coming, because I had her voice. And I stood there and I went, Dawn Evans! Which I then let my father listen to, because, you know, at this point they're buds, right? The really cool kind of thing that tied them both together is, Julie and I were talking about this earlier. They were who you thought they were. You know, they were good guys. I mean, they were humans. They put, you know, one boot on at a time. They had their human moments. But the reality is, they respected their fans. Their fans meant something to them. They understood the power they had with their fans, and that's another important thing. Legacy for Roy and for Dale and for Clayton. For me, I hear from policemen. I hear from firemen. I hear from teachers and clergymen who all say, I chose a career of service because of your father. and not just because of the role he played, but because of who he was as a man. And I know that that's the same for you. I see a little getting a little clumped. Okay. But it's true. And that's very moving to me when I was asked that, what is your father's legacy? I had to kind of think about it. And I realized that's what's more powerful than inspiring someone else to be altruistic? To inspiring someone else to go, you know, I'm here to help you. Let me help you. There isn't anything better than that. I mean, entertaining is fantastic. We need entertainment. We need beauty in our lives. But that's a big deal. The Golden Boot Awards, Rob talked about it. Probably one of the most things. It was fun. It was the Golden Globes of the Western world, right? Everybody's kind of, let's face it, everybody was running. A lot of blue jokes. Thank you, Pat Bedroom. That was loads of fun, too. One of the last years of not just the Golden Boot Awards, but Dad and Dale were attending, Dad offered the Lone Ranger Creed. And Dale offered a prayer, and this is how the Golden Boot Awards were always started every year. So Julie and I thought it was kind of fun if I would offer the Lone Ranger Creed, and then we could pass it off to Dale. Oh, Julie. I believe that to have a friend, a man must be your enemy. That all men are created equal, and that everyone has within himself the power to make this a better world. And God put the firewood there, but man must gather and light it himself. I believe in being prepared physically, mentally, and morally to fight when necessary for that which is right. That a man should make the most of what equipment he has. This government of the people, by the people, and for the people shall live forever. That men should live by the rule of what is best for the greatest number. That sooner or later, somewhere, somehow, we must settle with the world and make payment for what we have taken. That all things change but truth, and truth alone lives on forever. So, thank you, Clayton, for that, and Lone Ranger for that. And I'd love to hear the prayer that opened this up. What did you think?
Dawn Moore, daughter of Clayton Moore, reciting the Creed of the Lone Ranger as part of the opening night ceremonies for Happy Trails, the new exhibit honoring the life and legacy of Roy Rogers and Dale Evans, now on display at the Hollywood Museum. Dawn Moore's father, Clayton Moore, co-starred with Roy Rogers in the 1948 Republic Studios Western, The Far Frontier. Happy Trails, now on display at the Hollywood Museum. Tickets and more information, thehollywoodmuseum.com. We've been playing highlights of these special opening night ceremonies for the Happy Trails exhibit via remote from the Hollywood Museum. The final speaker that night was Julie Rogers Pamelia. Julie Rogers Pamelia, youngest daughter of Tom Fox, the only biological son of Dale Evans by her first marriage, and the granddaughter of Roy Rogers and Dale Evans. Julie Rogers Pamelia, also the author of Your Heroes, My Grandparents, A Granddaughter's Love, a memoir of growing up with Roy Rogers and Dale Evans. Julie Rogers Pamelia also worked closely with Steve Michelmo, director of operations at the Hollywood Museum, in putting together the Happy Trails exhibit.
Yay, Julie!
And so it goes. And at this moment, Grandma would take the mic and be hard-pressed to ever give it back. She's talking. Yeah, whenever I get it. With a grateful heart, she would thank God for all of his blessings, for all of you gathered here. She would want all of you to know Jesus for Lord. She was a preacher, but she didn't stuff it down you. It was really strange. You could really stomach what she was saying to you because she was so delightful. I'm not quite sure how that worked. Because not everybody can do that. But she did. And as Rob Ward told me just tonight, he said, you know, make sure if you do say a prayer, which I'm talking about it, if you do channel Dale, just make your prayer at least 15 minutes long. She really, really was a talker. Grandpa used to say, you know what, honey, you're the president of the Talkers Club. And my Aunt Mimi, who's my cousin Lori's mom, she was the secretary, and my Aunt Cheryl was the vice president and all that. And one day we were sitting at breakfast, and he turns to me and he says, you know, I think you might be the newest member of the Talkers Club. I'm not sure that's good or bad, but okay, thanks. You know, when I was 9, I'm going to read just one. Don't worry. My chapters are only 2 pages long in this book. They're very short chapters. But there's a very special, special memory that I have of my grandfather in particular. When I was 9 years old, I was fascinated with books. I mean, fascinated. Everywhere I went, I looked for another gem to add to my collection. Now, you have to know that the word gem, I use it really loosely because it was merely a box of comic books, okay? Nevertheless, I was so proud, and I brought my fine specimens over to the house to show Grandpa one day. Love this, I thought. So I walked in, and he was sitting in his favorite chair watching TV right there. I mean, this was my view. This is what I'm talking about right here. I plopped down on the floor, and I scooted up beside him with my shoebox. He looked at me, pointed to it, and said, "What you got there?" "Gems," I said, very matter-of-factly. Turned off the TV and he said, "Oh, let's take a look." I proceeded to show him every gem in my very forgettable collection. God love him. He listened very patiently to my painfully long presentation. And then his eyes squinted and he shot me that mischievous grin which always meant something was about to get fun. And he said, "Bring your box and come with me." So off I pattered after him and out to the garage, and he gently took the box from me and placed it up on his long, sawdust-covered workbench, strewn with pieces of rock, wood, leather, bits of chain, and these weird, bumpy, round rocks he called geodes. "Watch this," he said. He took a geode that he had already cut open, and he spread the two halves apart, revealing the stunning crystals inside. "But it was so bumpy and ugly on the outside," I laughed. "I know," he said. "Look at this one." I was completely awestruck with the most beautiful stones I had ever seen, all right there on his dusty old workbench. He even showed me a few that he had already polished and cut to make polo ties with. "Whoa, you got good gems, Grandpa," I exclaimed. I was so intently focused on the moment that I didn't notice that he was putting all of them one by one into my box. Not until he put the lid back on my box when I picked it up did I notice it was now very heavy. I peeked. He smiled and said quietly, "Why don't you take these and add them to your collection?" He was a man of few words. Well, except when my cousin dropped a frozen turkey on his toe, and then we heard a lot of her. He was shy most of the time and found it hard to express his emotions. I put the box down and I hugged him tight. "Thanks, Grandpa." It's been over 50 years and I still have those rocks he gave me so long ago. I take them out every once in a while and the memory of that afternoon with Grandpa at his workbench comes flooding back like it was yesterday. I was rich and I felt it. But not because I'd been given beautiful stones, but because I knew my grandpa loved me. And that's priceless.
Julie Rogers Pomelia, granddaughter of Dale Evans and Roy Rogers, reading a passage from her book, Your Heroes, My Grandparents, A Granddaughter's Love, in which she recounts the story of the love for gems that she shared with her grandfather, Roy Rogers. By the way, the box of gems that Julie got from her grandfather is one of the items that are on display as part of the Happy Trails exhibit at the Hollywood Museum. The Hollywood Museum, 1660 North Highland Avenue at Hollywood Boulevard, in the historic Max Factor Building. Tickets and more information, thehollywoodmuseum.com. Our thanks to Danelle Dadigan, founder and president of the Hollywood Museum, as well as Roger Neal and Harlan Bull for allowing us to play audio highlights of the opening night ceremonies as part of our program this week. Matt Robertson, thank you so much for listening. Stay healthy, stay safe. We'll talk to you.
Riverfront Playhouse presents Gaslight Theater's Christmas Vacation by Catherine Burns and Mike Urema, with musical arrangements by Josh Lamoureux, directed by Aaron Stewart. See this delightful musical comedy set in a small town where Mark Grinsworth aims to create the ultimate Christmas for his family while maintaining his streak in the annual Holiday Lights contest. Tickets available at riverfrontplayhouse.net. Gaslight Theaters, Christmas Vacation, November 29th through December 15th. Sponsored by this station and these Pro Arts businesses.
If you haven't been listening to TV Confidential, this is who you're missing.
Louis Gossett Jr.
Eric Braden.
Danson Williams.
Burt Ward.
Peter Marshall.
Lindsay Wagner.
Loretta Swit.
Michelle Nichols.
Shirley Jones.
Louise Sorrell.
Ben Asner. A lovely, enchanting interview.
Conversation.
It wasn't an interview.
Well, thank you. That's what I try to do. I try to make this a conversation.
You made it.
That's TV Confidential.
Saturday morning at 11 on KCNR.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.